Chapter 32, Captain Moroni and the Title of Liberty. A wicked man named
Obama
wanted to be king over the Nephites. Many Nephites had left the church to follow him. If
Obama
became king, he would try to destroy the Church of God and take away the people's liberty. When Captain Moroni, the leader of the Nephite armies, heard of
Obama's
plan to be king, he became angry. Moroni tore his coat to make a flag. On it, he wrote a message to remind the people to defend their religion, freedom, and peace.
Doesn't anyone notice this? I feel like I'm taking crazy pills!
This is Infants on Thrones. The philosophies of men mingled with humans. We are the Quorum.
So we got, we've been the, what do they call them, the Yalkada, the Yalkada,
and
the compound there, and yeah, the white ISIS, vanilla ISIS. Taking place in Oregon, and this, it's just kind of blowing up the, not just the internet, but certainly the Mormon blogosphere. So we've gotten some requests to talk about it and try to analyze it. We were asked to do a smackdown, and I don't know how you'd smack this down, but when that came in, I thought, you know, I'm in this group, and there's this crazy guy who got really interested and has, as far as I'm concerned, is the veritable expert simply because he's chosen to read everything there is about the background and the ins and outs of why this Bundy clan is up there taking over a federal visitor center of some federal land up in Oregon. So I figured we'll bring him on and educate us on what the hell's going on and the connection of Mormonism and everything else. So we got Drew. Hey, Drew, thanks for coming on.
Hey, glad to be here. You bet.
So, yeah, what I'm interested in what caused you to be so interested in this topic and to learn so much about it.
I think part of it, of course, is the Mormon connection and having been, you know, born and raised LDS. I think it's also part of it is that I was really conservative when I was an active Mormon. And so I'm very versed in what that mindset is like. And, you know, I've had buddies who are big gun nuts and have kind of told me a little bit here and there about the Patriot and militia movement, although I've never personally delved into that until this Bundy Ranch thing that happened back in 2004, and then just most recently again starting to get curious about them. And I think in general I'm just always fascinated by topics where it seems like crazy people are involved. And I just really, like, I don't say it to be a jerk, but I just really think Ammon Bundy is crazy. But then on the flip side, I just also have this view of humanity based on nothing more than my, you know, personal human experience, that even the people that we think are crazy and bad and evil, from their own perspective, they think they're good. They think they're righteous. They think they're engaged in the good fight. And so I realized that no matter how misguided or bad or stupid or wrong I think they are, I'm just always curious to try to like put myself in their shoes and figure out their mindset, because I know that there's got to be some way that from their mindset they're right. And I just want to figure out, what is it? What cause is it? And what is your mindset that leads you to occupy a federal, you know, bird sanctuary?
Yeah. Well, I get
in the name of God.
Yeah.
And liberty.
I get a little annoyed at every topic on in the news or really anywhere where it really seems like there's only two sides. There's very much a false dichotomy of this is one way and this is the other way, and nobody seems to even attempt to see the other side. So when this issue with the Bundys, you've
right.
got you definitely have political leanings that are one way or the other without really taking the time maybe to critically analyze what brought them there in the first place and what their perspective is and those types of things. So maybe we can do some of that and actually at least give people a reason to hate them if that's what they want to do. So
yeah,
I want to start.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to get background. Sorry. So
sure,
I'd like to, you brought out some of the real, the background and where this thing started that wasn't with the Bundys, but with this group called, or this family called the Hammonds. Can you want to start there?
Well, I think it might be worth, I really think it's, in order to understand who Ammon Bundy is and what the current standoff is all about in Oregon, you have to go back to 2014 with the big standoff at the Bundy Ranch. Do you know,
all right, I do
know about that?
Yeah, no, I do know about it. I just want to interject here because there were some emails amongst the infants about whether or not people could come on. And Glenn pointed out, somebody said, well, I can't make it. And they said, oh, no, Drew's coming on. Just come in late. We'll be just past the introduction about 3 hours in, so it'll be fine. So
awesome.
Yeah, so the Bundys in 2014, the Clive Bundy. You're talking about the Clive Bundy.
I'm glad to know that I have a reputation for being thorough and informative.
That's right. But
okay,
yeah, so the
so
Clive
you
Bundy.
So you want to start with the Hammonds then?
Let's do that. Let's actually do that. And then
okay.
Focus on this. I don't know that the Clive and Bundy thing is necessarily directly relevant other than to show this guy's mindset. And I could be wrong on that.
It goes to what this guy's overall cause is. And the overall cause is, and this is one that has existed for 150 years, it's been a controversial political issue that usually is just smoldering under the surface in the Western states. But every now and then it flares up again. And the issue is the fact that the federal government in all of the states in the East, in the South, in the Midwest, the federal government only owns about 1 to 2% of the land in those states. But in the West, it's a totally different story. In the West, the government owns anywhere from 30% to 85% of the states. So the low is Montana, which is 30%. But in Nevada, where the Bundy Ranch is, the federal government owns 85% of the land. And it's just been a big political controversy that boils over from time to time. And I mean that's really what this whole thing is all about. Ammon Bundy's protesting.
Yeah. And Bundy takes a position, right? He cites to the Constitution says that the federal government shall not own land outside of D.C. or something like that, right?
Right. But because of you know what happened. In 1849, when gold gets discovered in California, and around the same time silver gets discovered in Nevada and Colorado, you know, and at this time, these are all federal territories. All of a sudden, Congress looks at this and says, you know, we're sitting on a gold mine, we're sitting on a silver mine with all these territories in the West. And so, when Congress decides to turn these federal territories into states, Congress does something that it's never done before, which is it decides, you know, instead of just hanging on to 1 or 2% of the land, we think we'd like to hang on to a lot more. And so Congress, when they turn these territories into states, they hang on to these huge swaths of land. And so ever since then, you know, you've got states like Nevada where 85% of the land is federally owned and federally managed, where essentially you've got this really odd situation where you've got this state called Nevada, but the feds own 85% of it. And so, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that if you're a logger, if you're a miner, if you're a rancher, you know, if you're you know, doing any sort of business in Nevada, it's the federal government who basically controls and regulates it all. And that is the big long-standing beef that the Bundys and a lot of other people in the West have.
And they do it under the guise of preservation and you know, environmental protections, and to prevent the loggers and the ranchers from coming in and just decimating these areas. I mean, the ranchers that are letting their cattle graze, as I understand it, that causes real damage to the land.
Right, and that all started in the 1970s. You know, previous to that, the federal government basically was just there to receive applications from, you know, businesses or ranchers that wanted to use federal land. The feds would let them use it and in return collect fees, whether it was mining fees or grazing fees. And so for a long time, the federal government didn't prohibit people from using these federal lands. To the contrary, they let people use them. What happened is there was a big shift in around the 1970s, where you have Americans have become a lot more environmentally conscious, and Congress starts passing a lot of environmental protection legislation. And one of the big ones was the Endangered Species Act in 1973. And that is when you have these situations occurring all over the West where if there's an endangered tortoise or there's an endangered, you know, snail darter, or there's some, you know, to most people, obscure endangered animal, all of a sudden the feds come in and say, well, hey, we've got this thing called the Endangered Species Act. We know you used to log and mine and graze your cattle here, but this is now classified as endangered habitat, and so you're not going to be able to do that here anymore. And you can I think you can put yourself in the Bundy's shoes and say, well, if my family, if our way of life is grazing cattle and we've been doing it on BLM land for decades and decades, I mean, the Bundy Ranch has been there since 1877. And then all of a sudden the feds tell you that you can't graze on that land anymore because there's an endangered desert tortoise. It feels to them like the government is choosing to put the importance of tortoises above people.
Yeah. So you got this, that's the principle that these, at least the Bundy clan, supports. But then you've got these Hammonds that are in Oregon. And this
right.
is what they're kind of taking up
and
who they're taking up for.
Right. I mean, the Bundy Ranch standoff with the feds in 2014 was viewed by the Bundys and the Patriot Militia movement as a smashing success because they had this tense standoff with federal authorities. They had all these armed militia and Patriot people there in a standoff where, and you can see video footage of it. Literally the armed demonstrators are pointing guns at the federal law enforcement officers, and the federal law enforcement officers are pointing their guns back at the armed demonstrators. And it's this tense standoff, and ultimately the feds back down. And they release all of Ammon Bundy's father's cattle that they had been rounding up on BLM land. And so Ammon Bundy, it looks like, has been looking for another opportunity to have another quote-unquote success in Yep. in the Patriot Militia movement. And it looks like he zeroed in on these Hammonds up in Harney County, Oregon.
So I never realized the result or the resolution of that standoff there with Bundy up in Nevada. So he won, and he now gets to graze on federal land, and they don't stop him? Is that what happened?
He didn't win in that sense. The way he won was – or the reason the militia and the Patriots look at it as a victory is – the BLM and federal law enforcement came onto the BLM land where Clive and Bundy, that's Ammon Bundy's father, was illegally grazing his cattle. This was land that the Bundy family had used for decades, but that in 1993, the BLM came and said, because of the desert tortoise, you can't graze here anymore. Ammon Bundy's father said, well, to hell with you, I'm just going to keep grazing here anyway. And for the next almost 20 years, just continued to graze there, even though it was prohibited. And finally, the government had enough, and they wanted to let companies come in and start installing these solar farms in the area around the Bundy Ranch. There's a problem, though. When you want to install a solar farm on endangered desert tortoise habitat, the Endangered Species Act requires you to do something to mitigate, to increase the amount of desert tortoise habitat to kind of make up for the environmental damage you're going to do. And the main area that the BLM designated to restore desert tortoise habitat was this area called Gold Butte, right next to the Bundy Ranch where the Bundys had been grazing. And that is what made Ammon Bundy's father just flip out, because he looks at that and he says, let me get this straight. If it's me, just Joe Rancher, who wants to graze my cattle on this land, you tell me I can't do it because the desert tortoise is too important. But if a big company who's being legally represented by Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, most powerful, Democratic senator, if Harry Reid's son is working on behalf of a big company to come put in a solar farm on endangered desert tortoise habitat, you, the BLM, bend over backwards and find a way to allow him to do that. And so he just looks at that as, this is government being bought and paid for by big corporations. It's not really about the desert tortoise. It's not really about the average Joe. It's about who the big companies are, and are you, for example, employing the sons of prominent senators to be your lawyer. That's what the big beef was. And so in order for that solar farm to go in, the BLM had to do what it had previously failed to do, which is to take a hard line with Bundy and get his cattle off that land so that they could restore the habitat for the desert tortoise. And Bundy, despite a court order, Bundy refused to take his cattle off that BLM land. That essentially forced the BLM and federal law enforcement to go into that Gold Butte BLM land area and round up all of Bundy's cattle. And once they rounded up all of Bundy's cattle, the Bundys started hearing rumors that the feds were intending to euthanize all the cattle. And that is when Bundy and his hordes of Patriot militia followers or buddies with guns went to Gold Butte and had that tense standoff with the federal authorities. And as a result, the feds let the cattle go, but they haven't let him graze there. But the militia looks at it as a victory because they brought guns and they had a standoff with the feds, and the feds let the cattle go.
And they're not in jail.
And they're still not in jail.
and whether or not they actually broke a law then, or breaking a law now, is a discussion I want to have at some point. But so that's the backdrop.
Sure.
That's the 30-minute backdrop, which I actually do find interesting, that piece of it, to the Hammonds, who are also ranchers in Oregon.
Right. No. And my understanding is they're not ranchers in Oregon.
They're not?
No. Oh, I'm sorry. The Hammonds are ranchers
Hammonds.
In Oregon. I'm sorry. I thought you said the Bundys are ranchers in Oregon. No.
Yeah, no. The Bundys have connections to Arizona and Nevada. Ammon Bundy in Arizona, Cliven Bundy, his father, in Nevada from the standoff last year. But so the Hammonds are out there, and they're ranchers, and there's a father and a son. And let me see if I'm going to try to do that. Just do a quick thumbnail here.
Sure.
Just so I can feel like I'm talking too. and then tell me if I've missed anything. But there's a father and son that are the Hammonds. They're ranchers back in, I want to say 2001.
there was a fire that ended up in some acreage of federal land. It turned out that it was that the father and the son ranchers had also done some burning on their property, and that property or those burnings may have contributed to the fires on the federal land. And something very similar happened in 2006, and they were ultimately charged with under a terrorist statute of arson or destroying federal property. And they were convicted and are facing 5 years in prison for that. And I know there's some other details that make what they did seem less criminal, I guess, which probably is worth going into. That's your cue to clean me up.
Oh yeah, I mean the main thing there is that I think the two main points there are, number one, I think most Americans would be surprised to know that you can be convicted of violating an anti-terrorism act without being a terrorist. And without...
Yeah, there's no element to say, hey, you've done these things and you're a terrorist.
Right. I mean, what happened was in 95, you have the Oklahoma City bombings. And so the next year, Congress wants to do something to make it look like they're doing something to stop terrorism. So they passed this act called the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996. And they lay out all these crimes for destruction of federal property. And of course, in the context, you know, when we're thinking destruction of federal property, we're thinking, oh, I don't know, someone driving a Hertz truck full of, you know, gas and fertilizer that blows up a federal building. I mean, that's what everyone is thinking of. But the way the act is written is all the prosecution has to prove to convict you of, you know, arson or destruction of federal property is that you intended to do something that ended up destroying federal property. And because these Hammonds lit these fires that spilled over onto federal land, and a jury felt that these Hammonds did actually have the intent of burning some of the federal land, the jury found that these guys were guilty. And what happened is that the sentencing, the judge looked at this and says, well, I know that there's this mandatory minimum 5-year sentence that I've got to give these guys under the statute, but this just doesn't seem to fit the circumstance. These guys aren't terrorists. They didn't kill anyone. Mother Nature's already taken care of the damage. All the juniper and sagebrush has grown back. The judge says, I think it would violate the Eighth Amendment, which prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. I think it'd be cruel and unusual punishment to send a 70-year-old rancher and his son to jail for 5 years for burning some juniper trees and sagebrush. And so the judge only gave the father 4 months and gave the son 11 months. They served their time. Meanwhile, the prosecution appeals to the Ninth Circuit, asked the Ninth Circuit to make the district court impose the mandatory 5-year sentence. Ninth Circuit agrees with the prosecution. And
that,
these guys
that never happens, by the way. The Ninth Circuit never agrees with prosecution.
Right, right. I think the Ninth Circuit was putting its finger in the eye of Congress on the issue of mandatory minimum sentences because it wanted to show the ridiculous outcomes that can happen when you've got these mandatory minimums. So long story short, these Hammonds get ordered to turn themselves in so that they can go back to jail for another 4 years. And they're ordered to return on January 4th of this year. And it's since been announced that they have turned themselves in, but that's where our buddy Ammon Bundy comes onto the scene to try to offer to help them.
Or to stage this protest, at least.
Right. I mean, what he did is he talked to the Hammonds in November of just last year and offered basically to do Bundy Ranch Part 2 or Bundy Ranch all over again, which is, hey, I'll rally a bunch of militia guys and you guys can refuse to turn yourselves in, and we, the militia, will surround your property with a bunch of armed guys with guns, And if law enforcement comes and tries to arrest you and cart you off to jail, we'll do a standoff with them like we did down at the Bundy Ranch. The Hammonds turned him down, though, which,
right,
of course,
the Hammonds
was smart.
Nothing to do with the Bundys.
They didn't want to touch you with a 10-foot pole.
And since this whole standoff thing, the Hammonds have specifically denounced them and said, we have no part of this. This isn't us. This is all Bundys.
Right. I mean, because at this point, their best hope for, I mean, this dad, it's a father's son, these Hammonds, and the dad is 73 now. And so he's 73. He's looking at not being able to get out of jail, you know, till he's 77, 78. There's a good chance the guy's going to die in jail, right? So at this point, his best chance for not dying in jail is a presidential pardon. And so, you know, you can see when you're crossing your fingers for a presidential pardon, the last thing you want to do is get yourself mixed up with a bunch of militia guys.
Yeah, right. So for some reason the Bundys say, rather than doing this, we're gonna go storm the beaches of a visitor center at a bird sanctuary in Oregon.
Right. That's what they did just this last Saturday. They held a little, you know, they went and they rallied a bunch of locals who were sympathetic to the Hammonds. They, you know, brought in a bunch of militia guys from outside of Oregon. And there's a lot of people in the militia movement who are upset by how Ammon Bundy and this other guy named Ryan Payne, how they pulled this off, because what they advertised to the locals was, come out and just participate in a demonstration and a protest. We're going to go to this wildlife refuge where these federal offices, and we're going to carry around signs and chant slogans, and we're going to, you know, say how pissed off we are about what they've done to the Hammonds. And what happened is, you know, all of that happens, but then at the end, Ammon Bundy and a group of these militia guys say, hey, we want to occupy this visitor center at a at a wildlife refuge. And a lot of the locals are looking at this going, what the heck? I mean, I signed up for a protest. I signed up for a demonstration. I didn't sign up for an armed occupation. That's like a whole other animal. So a lot of people feel like, you know, Ammon Bundy was not upfront about what he was really there to do.
Right. So the main thing, or the main conversation, I think, has been around, because they've used the Mormon tie-in, because they've used Ammon Bundy and his dad, and leading up to this and this whole standoff now, have used scriptures and a lot of the rhetoric we see in the Mormon church.
Right. And I mean, Ammon started doing this back in November. He starts sending out emails to, you know, all his militia networks, telling them to stand at the ready to, you know, it signals that he's working on something. In these emails, he's quoting lingo for, you know, Mormon lingo. Like, for example, he says, and he has said, you know, ever since this occupation started, he's used expressions like, you know, what the federal government does to us will be a type and a shadow of what will happen to the government. And that's like right out of Abinadi telling King Noah, when Noah orders him to be burned at the stake, hey, what you're doing to me is a type and shadow of what's going to happen to you. So it's very clear that Ammon Bundy's mindset is immersed in the Book of Mormon struggle between, you know, sometimes in the Book of Mormon there's a righteous government, but sometimes in the Book of Mormon there's a wicked government. And you've got like heroes like Captain Moroni in Alma chapter 60, who write a letter to the government and say, if you don't do a better job at protecting the liberty of the people, I'm going to come to you with my army. I'm going to come to the Capitol. I'm going to come to Zarahemla, and I'm going to smite you with a sword, and I'm going to stir up insurrection everywhere. So it's pretty clear that that's what Ammon Bundy's mindset is.
Yeah. So he's clearly tied to this Mormon rhetoric of you know, we have the right to overcome or overtake a wicked government, and this idea of personal liberties trumping other things. And then you mentioned Captain Moroni. There's actually a Captain Moroni figure in the Bundy standoff. Who is this cat?
Yeah, so I haven't come across his name. He's calling himself Captain Moroni. You know, but what I find so interesting about that is that in the build-up to in all the build-up to the anticipation of the Supreme Court ruling on same-sex marriage, and then ever since then, Captain Moroni and the title of liberty has come up over and over and over again in LDS sermons. I mean, sermons by general authorities. You had in April of last year, Elder Hales gave a talk about defending religious liberty, where he recounts these Book of Mormon stories of the righteous rising up against a wicked government, and says that the members of the church need to be prepared to do that. And then in that talk, there's some pretty strong rhetoric. Elder Hales quotes Joseph Smith as saying that he's ready to die for liberty. And, you know, that when you have if you're Ammon Bundy and you're already, you know, in this sort of tense anti-government mindset, when you have an LDS general authority getting up and invoking Captain Moroni and the Book of Mormon stories of rising up to defend liberty against a government that's doing a bad job of it, and telling the members of the church they need to be ready to die like Joseph Smith was, if you're Ammon Bundy, I mean, I can see how someone who takes the Book of Mormon so seriously and someone takes the rhetoric that's been going around the last year or so from general authorities, when he takes it seriously, you can see how from his mindset he's justified in taking some extreme action.
Yeah, and the thing I kept thinking about as I was reading about this and hearing him quote scripture and do all these things was the Lafferty brothers from Crack Hour's Under the Banner of Heaven. And that's really kind of the theme of Crack Hour's book, where he says, look, there are real people that take their religion seriously, take their religious leaders seriously, and really thinks that it means the scriptures that they have mean what it means. And, you know, juxtapose that concept with what often many Christians and some of the leaders of the country in talking about ISIS and the propensity of the Muslim religion to produce terrorists and extremists, is the word, and without really acknowledging that every religion does have the ability to and does create their own extremists, fundamentalists, radical, and in many cases, violent people from their own religions.
Right. Even in the religions that are known as being pretty peaceful, like Buddhism and Hinduism, even they've had their extremists.
Right. So that's what I was thinking about. This is exactly what you would expect from the Mormon Church, or from somebody who really believes what the Mormon Church is telling them about religious liberty, personal liberty, and these types of things that they've been reinforcing in the gay marriage fight. But now it's being applied pretty easily, those concepts, to land rights.
Right. Well, what it does is it puts a spotlight on a tension that's existed within Mormonism from the get-go, which is the tension between this Protestant idea that you don't need a middleman. All you need is a direct, a direct relationship with Jesus, and, you know, just follow your conscience, follow the Holy Spirit. And that was Joseph Smith in the very beginning, right, with the Sacred Grove and everything. So there's a huge emphasis on personal relationship with God and getting your revelation directly from him. And then, of course, we know the history where you know, Joseph saw there was a downside to that, which was it can create leadership conflicts. And so then, of course, he built up, you know, more of a hierarchy and more of a authoritarian model that put himself at the top. That ever since then, the church has been very keen on maintaining that idea that, you know, when it comes to your personal life, personal revelation's fine. Everything outside of that, when it comes to church doctrine, what's right or wrong, you know, that's what the brethren, you know, the
right.
people in authority, the people within the institution that have the authority, they're the ones who get to call the shots. And
yeah. and the idea that we will tell you what God – not just what God says, but we will tell – we will interpret Scripture for you. And so your only job is to follow the leaders, follow the prophets, and we'll tell you what all this means.
That's right. And what we see is that historically the people who have believed more – in and relied more on the concept of personal revelation, those are the ones that end up splintering off and you know, becoming fundamentalists. You know, whenever they think the institutional authorities are straying from, you know, the gospel or straying from precedent, and whenever they feel that God is personally calling them to depart from or deviate from the institution, a fundamentalist group breaks off. So, you know, the big, you know, mainstream Mormonism is all about respecting the authority of the institutional leaders. Fundamentalist Mormonism has always had more of a reliance on personal revelation, and heeding the call when God tells you that the institution has been corrupt. Has been corrupted, and that you need to create your own new institution. And Ammon Bundy honestly seems to have a more fundamentalist mindset in that respect. I haven't heard that he's an LDS fundamentalist. From what I know, he's a member of the LDS Church, but you can see that what he's doing is exhibiting a more fundamentalist Mormon mindset that relies more on just personal revelation, because he says he feels God has called him to do what he's doing up in Oregon right now.
Right. No, he specifically said that. And I can confirm Ammon is just kind of a run-of-the-mill, or at least was a run-of-the-mill member of the Mormon Church, because he happened to live in a few stakes over from me. And I know somebody who was a leader in the ward who that Ammon was in the Phoenix area. And he said he was just a normal guy, didn't really stand out in any way, and until he started kind of spouting off on Facebook, and that was the first indication that he was kind of had maybe extreme views or was kind of on the fringe politically. But other than that, he was just a normal, active member of the LDS Church.
Right. And I think it's worth noting that, you know, there's a history of political extremism within the LDS Church that has included from time to time LDS leaders. I mean, you have Ezra Taft Benson with his affiliation with the John Birch Society, Bo Greitz. There has been from time to time a strain of Mormonism that becomes very political and, you know, in the 60s, 70s, 80s, you know, extremely conservative. And they are the ones who really rely on the Book of Mormon story. I mean, because, you know, we get told, it gets drummed into our heads that this was a book written for our day, reserved for our time. It's going to help us figure out our problems that we're going to have in our society, in our government, and it's going to show us the way of how to deal with them. And, you know, Cleon Skousen wrote books about that, and Glenn Beck has been promoting them all over the place.
Right.
And so, mm-hmm. you know, Bundy isn't, you know, the Bundys aren't just this tiny little isolated group in a vacuum. I mean, there is a lot of rhetoric going back decades and all the way back to Joseph Smith that at times is very politically extremist, and at times militant.
Right, well, and there's no right from Joseph Smith, certainly Brigham Young in Utah, and the anti. I mean, hell, they were secessionists,
right?
And they were as anti-government as you can get, and they constantly had these conflicts and supported the idea of battle with the U.S. government over and over again, from Nauvoo to Utah.
Right. Right. And so it's very interesting that, you know, what happened is that the occupation of this wildlife refuge happens on Saturday, January 2nd. The very next day, January 3rd, there's a – I think he's ex-Mormon because he mentions in an article. There's a writer who contributes to BuzzFeed. His name is – and I'm sorry, I don't know how to pronounce his last name, so sorry if I mispronounce it. Jim Dalrymple? Is that right?
Dalrymple?
Sorry about that, Jim. Anyway, Jim
– The second. So Jim
– Say again?
Dalrymple – Jim Dalrymple the second.
Yes, you got it. He apparently is ex-Mormon. He mentions in one of the articles that he was raised LDS, and he publishes a couple pieces in BuzzFeed, and one of them is entitled "You Need to Understand Mormonism If You Want to Understand the Oregon Standoff," and it goes into this history that we've just been talking about, the history of
Book of Mormon,
right,
Joseph Smith,
the militancy, the extremism, the tension with government. And the same day he follows it up with another piece that is called it's just called "The Leaders of the Oregon Standoff Have Been Calling for Action for Months." But what he does is he quotes email after email after email that Ammon Bundy's been sending out to militia folks, where he's invoking scriptural language to justify what he's planning. And so those pieces get published on BuzzFeed on January 3rd. My guess is that that is what prompted the LDS Church to issue a press release on January 4th, distancing itself from Ammon Bundy, saying it has nothing, you know, to do with it, and furthermore asserting that LDS scripture does not in any way justify what Ammon Bundy is doing.
Right, and the church's – so this we can just read that. The church says, "Church leaders strongly condemn the armed seizure of the facility and are deeply troubled by the reports that those who have seized the facility suggest that they are doing so based on scriptural principles. This armed occupation can in no way be justified on a scriptural basis." Really? Can it? Can it not?
Yeah, I mean, you've been a criminal defense lawyer. I've been a civil defense lawyer. I think maybe if you want, we could spend a little time being Ammon Bundy's defense lawyer. And, and you know, we've already kind of done it, explained how there are scriptures you could look to and see as justifying taking this sort of action. For example, in Doctrine and Covenants, it says that we believe in being – that people should be subjects, loyal, obedient subjects to government, as long as those governments are securing liberties for their people. So it's not an unconditional, absolute acceptance of governmental authority. It's conditioned on – government respecting the liberties of the people. Well, what have we had going on the last couple of years? We've had LDS leaders, including apostles, getting up at General Conference saying that religious liberty is being trampled upon. So if you put that DNC together with what the leaders have been saying recently, you don't have to support the government right now because it's violating our religious liberties. You right. don't have to be obedient to the government. You don't have to recognize its authority.
And I just beyond that, beyond the recent rhetoric, I haven't seen an animosity towards a president from members, generally speaking, members of the Mormon Church in my lifetime. I mean, Bill Clinton was bad. They hated him, but they really think Obama is the devil.
Yeah.
So there's this anti-government sentiment, I think, just generally or currently because of the – I shouldn't say anti-government, anti-this government over the last 8 years.
Right.
And they have this idea that they understand the true government and the true United States and what the Constitution really means and what's been going on over the last 8 years with this president and these activist liberal judges, whatever the hell that means, and you know that's an indication that they have, you know, that they're basically in apostasy from a constitutional standpoint.
Right. Absolutely, and then you've got, you know, LDS general authorities saying, you know, religious liberty needs to be defended. We need, you know, calling to action and invoking Joseph Smith quotes about we need to be ready to die for this kind of stuff. But anyway, regardless, Ammon Bundy got thrown under the bus and disavowed.
So it brings me to the idea of the connection to, you know, some of these they keep calling them terrorists, the vanilla ISIS and the terror that they are, you know, these rancher terrorists. And what do you think about the idea of comparing them to terrorists or to ISIS or to Al Qaeda? Yal Qaeda is the other one, you know, comparing them to Al Qaeda.
Yeah, I like Yokel Haram too. Yokel Haram was another one. Yeah, you know, interestingly, the one who started calling the Bundys domestic terrorists was Harry Reid. He did that just a few days into the whole standoff between the Bundys at the Bundy Ranch and the BLM back in 2014. I mean, here's where I see an overlap with terrorists and here's where I don't. I mean, starting with the obvious, they're not killing civilians for the purpose of instilling fear in the population in an overall concerted effort to, you know, defeat the U.S. government. On the flip side, there is a parallel in that Bundy is adverse to the U.S. government. And furthermore, that the authority that he's claiming for his actions are that he's got God on his side and he's got guns. And there's a funny meme I saw today where it has Ammon Bundy saying, God told me to fight against the United States government. And then right next to that is a picture of a jihadi holding a Quran and he says what he said. And so on one hand, you do have Ammon Bundy, like ISIS or Al-Qaeda or whoever else, saying God is telling me to, you know, use my guns and stand up to the U.S. government. But in terms of the way I think the average American understands terrorism, what a terrorist is, you know, it's people who target and kill civilians just to create terror.
And at this point, they haven't broken a law. They haven't done anything. It is right now still a peaceful demonstration. It certainly, you know, has guns and there's tension. There has the potential to turn violent, but it hasn't yet.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that we were talking and we're in a Facebook conversation, basically not just you and I, but a group of people. And there was a conversation of, well, they just need to go in and arrest them, but arrest them for what? Because as we understand, they haven't been asked to leave yet. So they're not trespassing. They haven't damaged any property. So they haven't committed this terrorist act of damaging federal property. They haven't hurt anyone. They haven't kidnapped anyone. They've let people both come on and off as long as they're a citizen, apparently. So there's a real question of what have they done either illegal or wrong at this point.
Right, and since that conversation, I've done a little more digging, and I think I found a couple things that law enforcement will be able to charge them with. And I can't remember the name of the crime, but it basically has to do with, you know, blocking access to a road, you know, like a federal road, or blocking access to a road to a federal facility. They have been doing that. I've seen photos that they've taken BLM vehicles that were on the property and set up these little roadblocks. So they could get dinged there. But I also looked at a statute that defines sedition. And if you conspire to overthrow the government, that's sedition. And that's a big deal because it carries a penalty of up to 20 years in prison. And Ammon Bundy has made statements in the course of all this where he has said that, you know, we're here, we're staying here. So they've said we're taking federal property and we're not giving it back. And then he's also said that he hopes that this inspires, you know, similar actions all across the country. We also know that he's deeply embedded in the militia movement, has been sending out emails and is encouraging people to come and assist. So, you know, if I'm a federal prosecutor, I'm gonna characterize this as sedition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's interesting. But it sounds defense attorney mode is, but he hasn't asked for the overthrow of the government or even encouraged it. He said encourage people just to do similar protests. So if that's no different than, you know, some of the marches, the civil rights marches, or those things that go on where there were calls to people to go certain places or to demonstrate. Nobody said go throw these people out of office or do anything. So I think they'd have a tough time. I think they'd have a tough time making that one. Although I could see that they'd be tempted to do it. But yeah, I don't see that flying.
Yeah, I mean, this is if you look at it, this is a sit-in with guns. Sit-in.
It's like Gandhi with guns.
Right? Right, exactly. It's not a big deal. no, I mean,
and apparently they don't have
sit-ins
either,
been going on.
It is Gandhi because they don't
have they're on an involuntary hunger strike. You know, sit-ins are a thing that's been around at least since the civil rights movement. We saw one, you know, probably the biggest one since then was probably the Occupy Wall Street, where they did go and occupy some city land and refused to get off of it. They didn't bring their guns. But from what I can tell, the government treated the Occupy Wall Street movement with kid gloves. And so far, the federal government's been treating the Ammon Bundy, Oregon situation with kid gloves too. According to Ammon Bundy, the feds haven't even made contact with them and they haven't even asked them to leave. And so the feds are being really smart because they're not giving Bundy what he wants, which is an armed standoff with federal authorities that will serve as a magnet, you know, a beacon and rallying point for all the militia people all over the country. Instead, what the feds are doing, it's so smart. They're having the local sheriff be the spokesman. And the local sheriff, I don't know if you've seen him, but he looks like a guy who, you know, is a rancher who lives in rural Oregon. And he's not intimidating. He's not overbearing. And he's been respectful. And he's just respectfully asked Ammon Bundy and that group to leave. So, you know, so far, there is no armed standoff, and the feds are taking a low profile on this.
And just, I think the standoff in Nevada last year, I mean, this all, to me, goes back to Waco, and there's
right.
No way that they're going to let that happen, anything near that happen again. I mean, that was, that's just
right.
Such a black eye on the federal government, and no way they do that again.
Right. Both Waco and Ruby Ridge have been the moral justification that the militia movement has pointed to basically make their point that we have a tyrannical, hostile, aggressive, murderous government that needs to be resisted and possibly overthrown. And it seems the federal government's learned their lesson from Ruby Ridge and Waco, that when they go in with brute force, they only make the militia numbers grow and create militia sympathy. And so what we've seen since Waco and Ruby Ridge, there was a standoff in Montana. I don't know if you remember it. It was called like the Montana Freeman. And the feds handled that totally differently. They didn't, you know, surround the ranch with a bunch of guns and, you know, start firing or anything like that. They, you know, relied on negotiators to bring a peaceful resolution to that. And it looks like that's the tactic that the federal government's taking here as well.
Yeah, they're also trying to turn them into Cuba by just isolating them.
Right.
And turning off their heat and the electricity, which they certainly don't have a right to, and it's not theirs. And they don't have food, so they're asking for people to mail them food or somehow try to send them food.
Yeah, I mean they've asked for. I mean, people have probably seen the memes going around about that. You know, the "Don't Tread on Me" flag, but "Don't Tread on Me" has been replaced with "Please send snacks." I mean, it makes them look. I mean, if ISIS is the JV of team of Al Qaeda, it makes Ammon Bundy look like the JV team of the American militia movement. I mean, it looks, you know, and he's also the most inarticulate spokesman of any political cause ever. The press has been basically twisting his arm in interviews to try to get him to say what he wants. And initially, he was just super vague and said, well, we're just here because we want the people to be free. And, you know, we've got a terrible tyrannical government and we just want people to have liberty and have freedom. And they've been pressing him since then. And so he has come up with a couple demands. He says that he'll leave the property if, number one, the Hammonds get released from jail. And number two, if the ownership or control of this federal wildlife refuge is turned over to state or local control.
The attempt to be so PR savvy is taking a page out of the Mormon Church's book when they were dealing with gay marriage and those things, because it was always, we are pro-religious freedom, pro-religious rights. It was never. They did a good job of embracing that, because the pro equality side was just, this is about equality and our rights and equal rights. And they said, no, it is about, it's about equal rights. It's about our equal rights, the religious rights. So they did a good job doing that, and that's what Bundy seems to be trying to do, although with a lot less skill, I guess.
Right.
Forgot what else I was going to ask. So we've covered a lot. That's pretty good. What else did we want to cover?
I think if you got a second, let me look back at just the little thing that I set you earlier with possible, you know, angles of this to cover. One second here.
The other thing I thought found interesting is some of the rank and file members of the church who supported Bundy, certainly before the Mormon Church came out, but even since then, it's rare that you hear members of the church, and by that I mean the active attending members of the church, criticize the church for taking a stance. The closest thing was the policy change that came out. That was the closest thing where you got people kind of criticizing and saying things about the church. But usually when they speak, the thinking's been done and the members respond. But here I heard a lot of people, or saw a lot of people, that are just run of the mill, the rank and file members, you know, Chapel Mormons, saying, well, the you know, the church doesn't really know what's going on. They're making the statement without really understanding the facts. And I was just blown away by,
right,
by how willing people were to continue to support, at least in principle, what the Bundys are doing.
No, I know. I notice when I go to the Bundy Ranch Facebook community, well, first of all, I was surprised to see how many likes that community had gotten. When I first looked at it, it was around 130,000. I thought there was no way that many people would even know who the Bundys are or sympathize with them. I got to tell you, though, just in the last 2 or 3 days, they've picked up an additional 15,000 likes on that page just from this additional publicity. And I noticed that two of my Facebook friends had liked the Bundy Ranch page. And I know, you know, one of our mutual friends in the group that we're, the Facebook group we're on, he mentioned that he has 8 LDS friends who have liked that Bundy Ranch community. And,
that blows me away.
Yeah. Well, let me put it this way. I don't know about you, but there's been a very significant shift in the attitude some of my LDS family members and friends have taken towards the U.S. government as a result of same-sex marriage issues and the legalization.
Yeah,
and,
yeah,
for example, I had one extended family member tell me that he can't even sing America the Beautiful anymore because he doesn't feel the emotional conviction that go along with the lyrics to that song, and has the same experience when the Star Spangled Banner is played at baseball or hockey games, that because of the rhetoric that's been coming out of Salt Lake, they feel like we are in one of those tragic Book of Mormon periods where the government is not living up to its divinely mandated responsibility of protecting liberty, and in particular, religious liberty.
And what is the, man, what's that? What's the scripture? Is they shall, if they are, they, I'm not going to get it now. They are something, then they shall mourn, when they're talking about the religious.
Yeah, Ammon Bundy quoted that in one of his emails. When the wicked rule, the people mourn.
That's it. When the wicked rule,
right,
the people
mourn. Right, and so I know you mentioned that earlier that people wanted a smackdown on this, and you know the low hanging fruit is the looniness of a bunch of guys who, you know, don't seem to be, let's put it this way, it doesn't seem like they have a ton of formal education. I mean, you listen to them even talk about the Constitution, you can tell that they don't even really understand constitutional law.
Sure.
And so the low-hanging fruit is to laugh at this vanilla ISIS group and do a smackdown on them. If there's any smackdown I can offer, I offer it on the LDS Church, which is, when you guys get up in General Conference and publish Ensign articles that characterize that quote Book of Mormon scripture that comes from a time in the Book of Mormon when the government was being run by wicked men who were corrupt and who were not defending and protecting the liberty of the people, and that's what you're quoting and likening it to the present day situation, and then quoting Joseph Smith about being ready to die to defend liberty. What we see with Ammon Bundy is the chickens coming home to roost. And it's not like this is the first time this has happened in Mormon history. You know, you had, Was it Sidney Rigdon who gave the salt sermon during the Missouri War? Which, and if you want to talk about a parallel. In the Missouri War, David Patton, who was one of the apostles, charged down a hill on a galloping horse with a rifle in hand towards Missouri militia and got gunned down. And in fact, last time I was in Salt Lake and went to the Church History Museum, they've got his rifle up on the wall. So you can't, you know, we've seen historical examples where strong rhetoric from church leaders has morphed into extreme extremist kind of action. And personally, my smackdown is on the LDS church leaders on this one, is Ammon Bundy is the chickens coming home to roost with all the rhetoric lately. It's been in the context of same-sex marriage and religious liberty, but it's all been based in Book of Mormon scripture of examples of righteous people rising up against a wicked government in defense of liberty.
Well, in fairness, the church really just wants to say, well, we just mean when it comes to genitals. When it comes to genitals, that's what we mean. Not when it comes to anything else. They need to make it more clear
because when you hold yourself out as God's mouthpiece on earth and people actually believe you and take you seriously, you better be extremely careful about what you say and how you say it. And if there are any boundaries or lines that you don't want your members to cross, if you want to make it perfectly clear what you're saying and what you're not saying, you have the responsibility to do that. Because we've seen that when they fail to do that, when they leave things kind of vague and open, like quoting Joseph Smith being ready to die for liberty, crazy stuff can happen. We've seen it happen before, and it's happening right now.
And it really, we all know that when they talk about religious freedom and protecting liberty, there it's a wink, wink to all those people who are anti-gay marriage, and that's the message that they're sending, and they're doing it somewhat cryptically. But your point's absolutely right. Is other people are hearing these messages, and the thing that they care most about, whether it be, you know, land rights or gun rights or, you know, something wrong with the government or hell, you know, some dispute with their neighbor that they just feel particularly justified in and wronged in some way, they can apply that to that scenario.
Right. And I would, you know, just kind of encourage listeners, go back and read Elder Hale's talk from April 2015, especially the last half or third, and put yourself in Ammon Bundy's shoes and ask yourself if there's anything in there that would make you feel like what you're doing is justified. Because there's some pretty strong rhetoric in there.
Yeah, including being willing to die.
Right, and that's what Captain Moroni, I don't know if you, that was the Captain Moroni quote, the Captain Moroni of the Oregon standoff. He's, you know, reporters asked him, why are you here? He said, I'm not here to kill anyone, I came here to die. So, and you've got Ammon Bundy quoting Abinadi, what happens to me is going to be a type and shadow. And that brings in another ISIS, you know, parallel, which is there is, you know, martyrdom is like the platinum status that you can attain as a jihadi. And it looks like, you know, with Ammon saying what you do to me is going to be a type and shadow of what will happen to you, he's looking at himself like a martyr, like Abinadi. He and Captain Moroni, they're ready to die. And they actually, it sounds like, and I attribute a lot of sincerity to these guys. I think they're extremely misguided and foolish to bring a gun to a drone fight.
Yeah.
But I think they're sincere, and I think it does sound like they have gotten some sort of personal revelation that they should stand up for liberty, even if that means martyrdom.
Yeah. Well, the idea that the Book of Mormon is, or the Quran for that matter, I guess, is are scriptures of peace or are meant to be religions of,
right.
of peace. They're not being honest with themselves. I mean, you mentioned the two. I mean, you got Ammon, the very guy who he's named after. This guy, the story of Ammon and being called to go to preach to the leaders of another people's government, and you know, he was the dude that chopped off the arms and all those
right.
things, right? I mean, this was not a nonviolent
right.
Character, and right down to Nephi,
right.
who's willing to, not just willing, commanded by God to cut off Laban's head in order to get what he needs, you know, in that case from the leader of a government. So it's very easy to apply, if it's to be likened to our day, it's very easy for anyone to apply it to these types
right.
of situations. And it doesn't end peacefully.
Right. For any church or religion that is still existing today, they started as a revolutionary movement, and they got a lot of pressure from the establishment in their times. That was true of Muhammad in the Middle East. You know, he started as a revolutionary, and so you've got plenty of justification of jihad and other things to, you know, protect people who are being oppressed by governments. But then once they take hold and become established, then of course there's no need for any call to arms against a wicked government anymore. You've got the same parallel in Mormonism, where it was just, you know, early Mormon history was just full of conflict between the state and federal government and the Mormons. But now it's become established, it's become somewhat mainstream, and there's, you know, until same-sex marriage, really, there was no reason for LDS leaders to cast, you know, the U.S. government leaders as being, you know, wicked or corrupt or trampling on liberty. So, as what I'm getting at is that in any church or religion, I think you're going to find both a justification for rebellion or revolution, and scriptures that say, hey, government's okay, we should be subject to government. And the leaders can then just pick and choose which of those scriptures they want to emphasize. And unfortunately, the ones that have been emphasized by LDS leadership the last couple of years are the Book of Mormon ones about, you know, wicked governments trampling on liberty and encouraging members to stand up and be willing to die.
Wow. That's all I got.
That's all I got. If there was a problem, yo, I'll solve it. Check out the hook
while DJ revolves it. And now for something completely different.
Hi, I'm Stephen Carter, the editor of Sunstone Magazine. Like you, I'm addicted to blogs and podcasts that explore Mormon themes, but I also want to be with people, the kind who are as curious about history, theology, and culture as I am. That's why I've been going to Sunstone Symposiums for more than a decade now. I want to explore new ideas. I want to see Mormonism from other perspectives. And, I'll admit it, I want to have lunch with my Mormon studies heroes. Sunstone has some great symposiums coming up, including one in Berkeley on January 30th, one in Mesa, Arizona on February 20th, and our first ever international conference in Birmingham, England from February 26th through 28th. Some of our speakers will include Wendy Montgomery, Dale McGowan, Natasha Helfer Parker, Christian Moore, Lindsay Hansen Park, and John DeLynn. Visit sunstone.org to learn more about our symposiums and magazine. Come join us. It's good to be together.
Thank you for listening to Impact on Thrones.